This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week we come to you from Beverly Hills, California, and the Forbes Travel Guide Luxury Summit at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. My next guest, I'm going to date myself now. We've known probably 25 or 30 years at least, from his days essentially being the champion, the visionary behind Ritz-Carlton. And then he went on to do other brands like Capella, and now he's free and clear to tell me the truth. Yes. Horst Schulze, how are you, sir?
Great. Nice to be with you, Peter.
How long were you at Ritz-Carlton?
19 years. Nearly 20, yeah.
From the very beginning?
Sure, before we had a hotel.
That's right. And then your flagship hotel initially was Laguna Beach?
Actually the flagship was Bucket in Atlanta. It was the first one.
Right.
So we saw that the flagship and our headquarters was right next door. So obviously it kind of evolved in the flagship.
But then once you had Laguna as a resort, then you really expanded.
It drove the recognition of the company dramatically. And Laguna had made huge impact and who we were and the recognition that we got.
You know, when you think of the definition of a five-star hotel, it doesn't take you long to figure out that, you know, you guys were part of that definition from almost day one.
Yeah, in a big way, I believe, yes.
But what did you do? I mean, I used to kid you all the time about the credo cards.
Yeah.
And lineup.
Yeah.
Lineup, people don't see this who are guests at the hotel, but if you go back of the house, every morning they had lineup.
That's correct.
What was lineup?
Well, lineup, we determined, what would be the 20 things that would make us superior to the competition. And so we taught those 20 things the first day when somebody started to work in the company. And then we repeated one point every day before every shift. If it is so important, you have to repeat it. And we had it then in the card that we gave everybody. People ridiculed me. Is this in religion? Everybody laughed about it 30-some years ago. Today, everybody does it.
If I remember correctly, the credo card said, ladies and gentlemen, taking care of...
Serving ladies and gentlemen. Yes. That was the motto which developed when I... In fact, that was an essay I wrote when I was 16 years old in hotel school. We are ladies and gentlemen, serving ladies and gentlemen, meaning we can define ourselves as people of excellence at work, or we sentence ourselves to be servants. So, and I took that with me. In fact, at one vice president's meeting in Hyatt, I said we should use that as, when I worked there for 10 years, great company, we should use this as a motto. Everybody laughed at me and ridiculed it. When I started Ritz-Carlton, I was
That's
in charge,
was.
So I put it in.
The other thing I loved about the credo card, I still have one, by the way.
Wow,
somebody gave me one.
Yeah.
That was the words, my pleasure and certainly.
Yeah. Peter, you have to understand, we in the hotel business, we hire center city kids who haven't seen elegance, and yet the next day after we hire them, they face the chairman of the board of the Bank of England. How do I make them elegant? By putting the right grooming, the right uniform, and say, don't use words like hey, guys, folks, dude, and tell them what words to use. Say, don't say okay, say it's my pleasure, I'm happy to, and suddenly I have an elegant employee.
Yeah, and you did that.
And we did, sure, we did that. And we taught it very strong. We taught with him 9 feet. You look at the guest no matter what you do, and you greet him and say, good morning, sir, or welcome, ma'am, or whatever, in an elegant way. And of course, it worked. You know, Peter, let's face it, it wasn't in one hotel we became the leader. We were in every hotel the leader, pretty much.
But you must shudder today when you walk into a hotel and you see kiosks.
Yes, but it's acceptable. You have to say, I think the future of the industry will very clearly be the commodity of sleeping and more of the individual, very elegant, very first-class hotels.
There'll be no middle ground.
I don't think it's much middle ground, no.
And, you know, when you think about it, you see the proliferation of brands over the last 15, 20 years. you know, Marriott now has like 32 or 33 brands.
Yeah.
I always say it's not enough to say you have 33 different brands. You have to define them.
Yeah.
And if you can't define your brand, you can't justify your rate.
Yeah, sure.
So do you really see 33 brands surviving in the Marriott, Sheraton, or Starwood merger?
No, they will not survive as such. There will be confusion about, there will be elimination of some of them, but they all will become commodities, and there's nothing wrong with that. Mind you, I'm not complaining about it. I check in sometimes late in the evening. I just need a bed because I check out next morning. I don't need something special for that. But they cannot and will not give real attention and real caring and real experience. And why should they?
They're a different hotel.
It's a different business.
Different business. We've been speaking to Horst Schulze, the original founding member of the Ritz-Carlton. I don't want to say chain. I'll say brand.
Yes.
Is that better?
Oh, much better. Thank
and
you.
And the author of the book?
Excellence Wins.
And so I'm talking to a winner.
Yeah. I kind of encompass in the book everything that we did to make the success of Ritz-Carlton and Capella.
Okay, so here's my question.
Yeah.
Who's following that today?
Who's following that? There are a lot of independents. That's why independents are coming back. As luxury hotels, exactly. And they're following it. They're following it. And they can. They don't have to report. Most of them don't have to report to Wall Street in 3 months again, where the concentration becomes the money. In the independence, the concentration is the thing that makes the money on that service.
This is what gets me. In the service industry, it could be the airlines, the cruise lines, the hotels. Anytime you're dealing with stock analysts, service suffers.
It has to, because the whole concentration, the whole analysis, there is no other analysis. There's no analysis about quality and excellence. There's the only analysis, the bottom line. So what has to give, everything else has to give. So, but the independents that come in, I know a number of them coming to me and say, we want to do a hotel, no brand. We want to do something unique and special. That's what the change of the industry will be, in my opinion, in the next, it will take 10, 15 years. Because that it doesn't change overnight. But
then they can also justify their rate.
Exactly. And they will be unique, and they will be sought out. I'm talking to somebody and helping them to think through about the hotel. It's going to be exceptional. It's going to shock everybody. Mm. But the brands cannot follow up on that. And you know what? They would be silly if they would.
Because
do
they
your thing.
They can't do it.
They can't do it. Do your thing and be the first-class commodity for sleeping. You know, they're sleeping factories, most of them.
And that's the problem. That's the problem. When you take an experience and turn it into a commodity, your price better go down.
Well, it has to, yeah.
Right.
And so well, not only because you turn it down, but that's the only thing you compete with sooner or later. Because you're certainly not competing with excellence. You're not convincing the guests to come back. You're doing to convince the guests with two things, with price and with points, not with your product. The moment you start giving points, you have kind of admitted, I cannot convince you to come back because of what I'm doing. I have to give you something else so you come back.
And when you were at Ritz-Carlton, you did not have a
frequent stay program. No, I did not.
In fact, you fought against it.
And how, yeah.
Yeah, you did. You wouldn't do it.
That's right.
But now Ritz-Carlton is part of Marriott, and now they have points.
Yeah, sure. They're working together and have to work together.
Right, but if you were starting a hotel today, you would not do that.
No, I would not.
But then everybody else has done it.
You see, the concentration have to be, once you, every employee should understand they're there to convince the guests to want to come back because of the experience each individual gives in caring and so on. So I'm convincing you if you come back. If you walk into the hotel, I will convince you. I promise you to want to come back because the experience that you have, and not because of a few silly points that you're going to get.
Now, here we are at the Forbes Travel Guide Luxury Summit.
Yeah.
What, in your mind, in the year 2019, qualifies as a five-star hotel?
Well, it's all customer concentration. All customer concentration. I concentrate on what the customer wants. You know a lot the customer wants. They want a clean hotel. They want and so on. We know all that. But then it has to be added to it is the individualization and the personalization. That means I have to create that hotel for the market as a whole, exceptional, and then respond to the individual 100%. That qualifies to be a great hotel.
And how do you do that if you're part of a chain?
Well, you obviously you can't. Let's face it. If we would play Ritz-Carlton, it was my fault that you cannot do it because I was part of creating 600 room hotels. I cannot individualize to each customer in a 600 room hotel. But
so what's the tipping point on the number of rooms?
Well, in my opinion, it's 100. If you are in a city where you have individual, because I say 100 because then you don't have to go for groups. And the top market doesn't want groups. But if you're in New York, you can have more rooms, obviously,
right.
And you can still do it. If you have 200 rooms in New York and there's an average stay of three, you have a maximum of 60 check-ins a day. You can handle that still. But if you have a group coming in of 180 or something, you cannot handle it anymore.
Especially and if it's every day, yeah.
And you go directly against the customer, that particular customer who wants to be. We studied something. I have just thought about it. That's kind of funny. We studied about exactly that in a focus group. And one guest said, well, I love these luxury hotels, the names you all know. But when I go there, I go in the elevator and I'm pushed in a corner by the guys that are there with the beer can collectors convention. And I don't like it. You see, that's what it is. And there's nothing wrong.
Because they've got to fill
it.
The rooms.
And of course, they have to fill the rooms. That's what I'm saying. There's nothing wrong with what I'm doing. It's misunderstood when I make comments about it, said I'm complaining about it. I'm not. They should be smart and say, we are going to be the leader in that particular segment, but not
beer hotels. I got it.
Beer. That's it.
No, but the bottom line is you're saying above 100 room hotel, except in maybe cities like New York,
yeah.
You're going to have a problem maintaining standards.
Yeah, absolutely.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on.
As a matter of introduction, for those of you who weren't listening in the first hour, you know, all these years that we talk about ratings, there was, you know, the AAA and the mobile and of course, so many other guides. And the question used to be, okay, who are these people? I mean, how do they actually rate a hotel? How do they rate a resort? What's the criteria that they use? What can we actually determine from that makes any sense? And I've always said this, you know, what makes a five-star hotel? If the hotel's got five stars because it has a golf course and I don't play golf, what makes that a five-star hotel for me? Well, the answer is, of course, it doesn't. I go back to the days of the original mobile five-star guide, and that has morphed now into Forbes. And joining me now, the CEO of Forbes Travel Guide, Philippe Boyan. Philippe, you heard my introduction. You've changed the metrics, haven't you?
We have, Peter. How do we inspect hotels? It's pretty simple. We have 900 rigorous standards, objective standards, if I may add, and 75% of these standards are based on service. That means we are all about how does
the guest... So it's not bricks and mortar, it's the service.
Absolutely not. This is all about how do we make the guest feel in our hotels. Of course, while the facility is crucial and we look at design, we look at quality of furniture and hardware, our standards emphasize quality of service. And that's because your experience in a hotel, a restaurant or a spa goes way beyond looks.
Okay, so let's talk about that. I mean, when you talk about a majority of the criteria is based on service, then you put these hotels to a test. Right,
absolutely.
and they don't know you're there.
They have absolutely no idea.
So you make a reservation using a card that can't be traced back to you, right?
Yes,
with names that can't be traced back to you.
Totally.
Right, and then, I mean, it's got to be my worst nightmare as a hotelier when you guys are in there because you're asking for things that you know, and you time it. You know, like how fast is the room service? Were the eggs cold? You know, did they give me the extra towels? I mean, all sorts of stuff.
Totally. And the fact that we pay all our bills. So we pay the normal hotel rate. We pay for all our food, all our beverages, all the spa treatments. And that makes it very sure that our inspectors stay completely incognito.
So basically, I should get a job with you.
You should try, Peter.
But you know what? If I've got how many different areas are they going to look at? Are they going to stay, two or three nights?
They're staying 2 nights, 3 days.
Okay, so in that two-night, three-day period, they have a checklist that you give them.
900 standards.
And they got to go through all 900.
Through all 900.
Now, if I'm a guest, let me be devil's advocate. If I'm a guest staying at a hotel,
right,
and I'm going through 900 items on a list, at a certain point, they're going to say, who's that weird guy in room 407?
No, because these inspectors will not show you anywhere they are in the hotel that they're filling out the list.
Okay.
Absolutely not. So this is why our inspectors are special people, right? They're very smart, they remember, and they write very well because all these standards and these reports need to be written out in an amazing amount of detail. So the hotel, when they get their report afterwards, know absolutely what went right, what went wrong, why did it go wrong, and what was the feeling of the guest in this hotel, right? So that is the most important for us. But 900 standards, it takes takes a normal inspector a good 12 hours to fill out an inspection report. So for anybody, I get asked the question all the time. We want to join you. We want to be a hotel inspector because, of course, there's a lot of people that want to go to the best hotels
in
the world.
Vacation, but,
but when I tell them it's going to be 12 hours of hard work to fill out this report in incredible detail, usually 90% says, all right, I get it. Not today.
Okay, so is there a passing grade of the 900? How many do you have to pass?
Well, it's very simple. If you want 5-star, you have to score 90%. 4-star, 80%, and recommended, 70%. And Forbes ratings cannot be bought. A lot of people, there is a pay-to-play perception.
You know, I remember, and this has nothing to do with anything to do with our current political situation, but I remember when Donald Trump was running around with a guy named Joe Cinque, mm-hmm. and they were offering, you know, these big star awards. And I said, how does somebody get one? Then I found out. You bought it. You paid for it.
Yeah. Well, that's not the – that is absolutely impossible with Forbes Travel Guide. You can buy – we have also support services that we offer hotels. So we have an incredible training team of passionate professional people that train not only in hotels, but they also train restaurants, they train spas, they train – healthcare, they train care homes, etc., etc. So you can buy those services because we have also a coaching function to fulfill for the restaurants, for right. the hotels and restaurants and spas. So if anybody wants to get better and requires our coaching services, we can sell them training, we can sell them additional quality assessments, etc.
But that doesn't buy them the 5-stars.
It does never buy them the 5-stars. Your rating, you have to earn it, and you have to score 90% to get to 5-stars.
So here at the Forbes Travel Guide Luxury Summit, how many 5-star hotels are represented?
Last year, we had 199 5-star hotels.
That's global.
Worldwide.
That's globally.
And this year, we added 35. Obviously, some dropped out. And we now have a total of 210 5-star hotels globally. And that tells you how difficult it is. It is amazingly difficult to get to 5-stars. This year we have a big announcement because the Peninsula Hotel Group is the first group in 61 years that achieved 5-star rating for all their hotels worldwide. So that is an absolute amazing achievement.
And you know, that brings up a very interesting point. People are always asking me, what's my favorite airline or my favorite hotel chain? And I say to them, for the airline, I don't have a favorite airline. I can give you my favorite airline by route. I can give you my favorite hotel by city. But if you are actually awarding 5-stars to only one hotel chain, which is system-wide for them, that's quite an achievement.
It is quite an achievement. But on the other hand, you also have to know, you also have to mention that Four Seasons, for example, that has a lot more hotels than Peninsula, has the biggest amount of 5-star hotels, which is 36 worldwide.
Right, but not all of their hotels.
Not all, because Four Seasons has over 100 hotels. So that is incredibly difficult to get there, right?
Yeah, amazing. So for one hotel chain, right, how many hotels in Peninsula?
10.
10. They are able to manage the product.
So it's a perfect 10, and obviously they did a big celebration with their staff. And
for
5-stars...
Well, it's great for employee morale.
They created 5 days for the staff where they gave them complimentary spa treatments, complimentary stays in their hotels. I mean, totally amazing. So in Peninsula...
You did such a good job, you get to stay here.
But I can tell you that every member of staff knows that they achieved 5-star Forbes, and they know how important their role is in the total guest experience.
Should there be a rapid change in cabin pressure, oxygen masks will automatically drop from the compartment above your seat, free of charge. And to start the flow of oxygen, pay your flight attendant $75.63. My mother, God rest her soul.
Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. My next guest has a particular distinction, other than the fact that we've known each other for about 30 years. He's laughing, but it's true. What's amazing is that his hotel, isn't one just one hotel. It's a number of hotels, I believe 10. Well, you know the hotel. It's the Peninsula. It's the first time in the history of Forbes that every one of his hotels has gotten a five-star designation. His name, Peter Borer, the Chief Operating Officer of Peninsula Hotels. Peter, welcome.
Thank you very much, Peter. And it's always a pleasure to meet you.
I mean, it's one thing if one of your hotels, you know, wins five stars, and I'll tell you why. Because people are always asking me, you know, like, what's your favorite airline? And I go, well, I don't have a favorite airline. Give me the route, and I'll tell you my favorite airline on that route. What's your favorite hotel? Well, I don't really have a favorite hotel, but give me the city, and I'll tell you my favorite hotel in that city. So to hear that you guys have won every one of your hotels is quite a remarkable achievement.
It's very kind of you to say so, and of course we're very honored to have received this accolade. It's, I believe, testimony to about 8,000 people around the world working every single day very hard, with dedication, and most importantly to me, with passion. Because good service, of course you need a brain, but comes from the heart. We're blessed that our company started over 90 years ago in the Far East. And
as a family-owned, family-run company.
That is correct.
Which it still is today.
Which it still is today. And the Far East, in my opinion, because of its culture, hospitality, is really part of the culture.
So, well, you know, I remember when I first went to Bangkok and when I first went to Hong Kong. And there's an old line from Groucho Marx, our famous comedian, saying, I would never join a club that would have me as a member, right? So when I was checking into the hotel, and it was your hotel before you built the tower,
right?
And in Hong Kong. And I was just checking in, I was going, there's something wrong. They must be meeting somebody else named Greenberg. Why are they being so nice to me? And then I realized it had nothing to do with me. It has to do with the culture.
Correct.
And that the good news was I had a great time. The bad news was I got so spoiled, I was never happy anywhere else because it was like, really? They're doing this for me? And then, no, idiot, Greenberg, they do this for everybody. You just haven't experienced that, right?
We're trying to, you know, form a very emotional connection between us and our clients, because to me it's not just about service delivery, it's not just about having a big chandelier in the lobby, but it's really to get a little bit deeper into people's lives, especially in today's world where we're all hurried. I believe that it is the greatest luxury to feel as a person and to feel a deep emotional connection to a brand.
Well, that's the key that I always talk about. When you try to define this almost impossible word to define, luxury, right? And you take a look at where the hotel business is these days, you know, a one-star hotel can define its brand. A five-star hotel can define its brand. The three-star hotels can't. And my prediction is you may not see a whole lot of hotels left in the middle anymore, because if you can't define your brand, you can't justify your rate. And you can't actually provide an experience that people are going to have, as you say, an emotional connection. So with all due respect, and I'm not trying to single out a single brand, but I would guarantee you that I wouldn't find many people emotionally excited to stay at the Sheraton in Cleveland. I'm just a guess. So why do they stay at the Sheraton in Cleveland? Nothing against the Sheraton. It's because either A, it's their company travel policy, B, they're getting points, or C, that particular hotel is attached at the hip to a convention center where they happen to be going to a convention. But nobody gets up in the morning that I know going, oh, my God, I'm going to the Sheraton in Cleveland. They don't do it. If somebody told me tomorrow I was going to the Peninsula in Hong Kong, I know you're going to laugh at it. I would actually get excited. Well, one of the reasons I've stayed there before, so I sort of know what to expect. Your challenge as a five-star winner is you have to maintain that expectation.
Correct. To me, you know, once you're sort of trying to work your way to the top, you have to be even more careful, because there's only one way to go, that's down. And that's clearly not the intention we're having. So
and
I think
you have to maintain it.
You have to maintain it. We are very, very fortunate that in our company, this passion and this dedication starts at the very top with our chairman, Sir Michael Kaduri, who himself is the most passionate and dedicated hotel owner you could wish for. And hence, his attitude, his commitment to all of us then sort of radiates down towards everybody in the company.
I remember the days he used to fly me in his helicopter over the harbor there in Hong Kong. Crazy. It was crazy. When we last left off, Peter, I wanted to talk about high tech versus high touch. Many years ago here in Los Angeles, in fact, 25 years ago, we had the earthquake, and my house was destroyed in the earthquake, had to be bulldozed. And now I had an opportunity, which I hadn't planned on, to rebuild my house from scratch. And when the architect sat with me, I'd never had an architect before, and the builder, I'd never had a builder before, and they said, what would you like in your house? I said, I have no idea. And they said, well, why don't you just sort of like outline for us what you'd like in each room? So I said, okay, let's start in the bathroom. I want the television in the bath like the Peninsula Hotel. And then, oh, I want an internet phone system like the Peninsula. I started listing all the stuff I'd experienced at the Peninsula Hotel, including the bathtubs. I mean, everything, right? I mean, and when you think about it, what are people really doing when they're staying in your hotels? They're test driving their own experience at home, right? Which is why so many things get incorporated from hotels now, because people have had that experience.
Thanks for the compliment.
But by the way, I'm going to tell you how it happened on the phone. I was checking into the Peninsula in Shanghai, and they walked me to the room, beautiful room, your general manager at the time, Joseph Chong, who's amazing. And I walk into the room, and three things happen, right? I saw the bathtub with the TV. I went, that was cool. I had seen it before in Hong Kong, but it's like, nice to see it again. The second thing I saw were the bathrobes and the towels, especially the towels. And I said to Joseph, okay, I'm going to a store. I'm going to buy three large suitcases, and I bought eight of your towels. Why? What's the letter on the towel? It's P. I had to do it. Yeah. Because they're not towels. A family of five can fit in them. It's great. And then, of course, came the VOIP.
Right.
That was brilliant. What you guys did in that hotel, and you now do it system-wide.
Right.
But what you guys did in that hotel is you figured out what are the negative touch points in a hotel, right? What do people really get angry about, right? Well, they get angry about the minibar, and they get angry about being nickeled and dimed. And, of course, every one of your hotels is in an international gateway city. They get angry about phone calls that are outrageously expensive, right?
Correct.
So you figured out, okay, VOIP, we'll use the internet, we'll make all phone calls free. Now, here's the funny thing. I'm sitting there, oh my God, I've died and gone to heaven. I can call everybody I know in the world, right? The reality is, I didn't. I actually called maybe three people. But the notion that I could created that connection that you're looking for. I'm sure the other guests are the same way. Nobody sits in their room barricaded there for hours calling everybody on their Rolodex.
No.
But the point is, the true definition of luxury is when you get to keep your options. And that's what a lot of the experience in your hotels is about.
Yeah. And to me, you know, the biggest luxury is to have a choice.
Right. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And to me, that's part of that choice. We've now expanded that what we call the ELV system, which, by the way, we develop in-house, and it's led by our chairman. So we've now had it in 11 languages. So even, you know, the instruction to how to operate the Nespresso machine comes out in Russian or French or German or Spanish. So we're trying to make the room very user-friendly. Of course, design is important, but functionality
is much
more
important. I no longer
have
to crawl around looking for an outlet.
No, you don't. That's there are multiple plugs that, you know, so you can just plug it in.
It's those little things that drive people nuts that you figured out.
Especially after a long flight,
yeah.
You don't want to have 20 minutes introduction to your room. You just want to get on with it.
Exactly.
And so we're always doing that. We have a laboratory in Hong Kong where we build test rooms. And currently we have three hotels under construction, one in London, in Istanbul, and in Yangon. And next time you come to Hong Kong, I'll take you to that laboratory.
I want to go.
And you can see what we're doing in the future.
Without revealing proprietary information, what's the one thing you're working on now that's going to blow me away?
Well, I believe it's that fine line between what you just said, high tech and high touch. Because to me, tech is obviously leading the entire world, but the touch part is incredibly important. So we're working on a what I would call quite revolutionary way of checking people in and out.
I will tell you this. Anytime a hotel tells you we've installed six more kiosks in the lobby, I don't check in. Because that, to me, is not progress. That's where technology takes precedence over the conversation.
Correct.
You still want to preserve the conversation.
Yes, and you want to look somebody in the eyes and feel that this person is genuinely interested in your well-being.
I mean, seriously, I mean, I was at the airport the other day. I actually had a ticket. My God, a ticket. And I said, guys, I need to change my ticket. And they had eight people behind the counter. I said, oh, we're only here to handle kiosk problems. I said, you see those kiosks over there? They are the problem.
Right.
You don't know how to have a conversation.
Yeah.
Right. So part of your training, I would assume that part of the reason why you're going to maintain this designation from Forbes is to continue the conversation.
Correct. And to me, again, in today's world, that's a great luxury to have a decent, well-educated confirmation where you look a colleague of mine in the eye and feel I'm in competent hands and this person's going to take care of me.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, people want their blankie. You know, they just want to be that it's going to be okay.
Of course.
Because when you're running a hotel that is in an international gateway city, you can assume a couple things. By the time that person gets to your front desk, they've been so beaten up by the airlines, right? that if you're just nice to them, they marry you.
Correct. And you see, everybody that comes through the door is in a different frame of mind.
Yeah.
Everybody that comes through the door has a different expectation. And I always hope that we meet about 80% of those, and then we're doing okay.
Well, listen, if you met 80% of those in the baseball leagues, you'd be in the All-Star game, and if you did that for a career, you'd be in the Hall of Fame. So 80% is not bad.
Where are the wagons?
The wagon is too slow. Can't you ride?
It's not that he can't ride. How is it you put it home?
They're dangerous at both ends and crafty in the middle. Why would I want anything with a mind of its own bobbing about between my legs?
This is the convening, if you will, of all the five-star hotels. Not easy to get one. When you think of how many thousands of hotels there are in the world, there are only about 215 of them that have that designation. Very difficult to get. If you were listening to the show earlier, you understood the metrics of how they do the inspections, how they do them basically incognito, really incognito. And joining me now is someone who has that distinction now as a five-star hotel and resort, Sheila Johnson, the CEO of Salamander Hotels. And if you don't know the name Sheila Johnson from the hotel business, you might know her because she was the co-founder of BET. And then I just have to ask the question, what did you know about the hotel business before you started a hotel?
I knew absolutely nothing. And the same when we started BET, we knew absolutely nothing about the cable industry.
But I guess when you say you knew absolutely nothing about the hotel business, you did know about the hotel business because you've been a guest at so many. You
That's
brought
right.
that knowledge and experience to the table.
That's right. But you, what I want to just back up a little bit, you know, I had three acts in life. And the reason why I really enjoy the hotel business. My first act of life was a concert violinist. So I traveled all over the world. And more importantly, I did a lot of concerts in Europe. And
so you were staying in a lot of hotels.
Wonderful hotels. And that's where it really piqued my interest about what are the fine hotels in the world.
Although I would guess you knew what worked and you also at that point knew what didn't work.
Exactly. And so then from being a concert violinist and then being a co-founder of Black Entertainment Television, which is also the entertainment business.
Right.
You know, I learned a lot. So these were all stepping stones, then going into the hospitality business. All I needed to do, just like we did with Black Entertainment Television, is we hire the best in the business to teach us how to run.
Now, if truth be told, I'm like every other guy you know. We always had a dream of having our own restaurant, and then we got smart about it
mm-hmm.
because we realized the failure rate, and what do I know about restaurants, right? Hotel was a dream of yours?
It was, and it still is. You know, I bought 340 acres of Pamela Harriman's property back in Middleburg, Virginia. And as soon as I walked up there, I said, I'm going to build a hotel here. But it wasn't just that decision. The town of Middleburg at that point was really almost in bankruptcy.
Right.
And they really needed people to come into that town.
They needed infrastructure.
They needed an infrastructure, and it was falling. Their underground infrastructure was falling apart. But by me building a resort there, I was able to build a water sewage treatment plant, which supports the town, and then to put up this wonderful resort. And what's happening, because the resort's there, we now have restaurants coming in. We have other small retail shops, bookstores.
Housing.
The place is coming alive. And it's because of the resort. And we call the resort Middleburg's living room.
Well, when you think about it, there's one thing about buying a hotel. You just did it from scratch.
Did it from scratch, from the ground up, did all the design work. And then
what's the one thing when you were doing the design work, you said, okay, every guest room has got to have this, and conversely, I do not want this in my guest room.
Yeah, you do that from traveling all over the world, and you're staying in some of the best, and you see what works and what doesn't work. You know, the frustrating thing is to be able to bring a suitcase in, and you don't know where to put the suitcase. There's not enough room. There's not enough drawers to unpack your suitcase. And you see a lot of that, especially in some hotels in New York, and you hope they have storage down there to take your suitcase.
Well, I judge a room by the bathroom. And by the way, this comes to me from all my women friends. There's
mm-hmm.
either, tell me if I'm right, either not enough light for you to put on your makeup, or, let's be honest, not enough shelf space for all that crap you guys bring with you.
Wait a minute now.
Now, come on. You know I'm right. I mean, but if you see a hotel bathroom that works, chances are the rest of the hotel works.
Well, some of the problems, because I'm so short, I wish they would look at the shelving when they're putting the sinks in and not make it so high.
Because
sometimes I need a stool just to see myself in the mirror.
So we have to put risers in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, when you were looking at the rooms on that kind of design, what did you say? I have to have this in the room.
What we do do is we build out a room and we build the bathroom. We build out the whole facility. Then we go in and we almost kind of live in it to see what's working and what doesn't work. And that is very important. And then we make sure we make changes before we build the resort.
I've always believed that no hotel room designer should ever be paid for their work unless they've been forced to spend two nights in it.
Yeah.
Right?
I agree. Yeah. I agree. But we had one of the best designers. Thomas Pheasant came in and did our rooms. And I knew exactly what I wanted. See, I had been living and breathing the whole construction piece because, you know, it took me 10 years to get that resort up.
Yeah.
10 years. So I was out here on the West Coast with WATG, and they're the ones that did all the design work for me. And that took almost 2 years to get all the design the way I wanted it. I designed all the sheets.
Let's stop right there. Talk to me about thread count.
Well, you want a 600 thread count. But you've also got to make sure the sheets you design has got to go through the laundry and make sure it doesn't fall apart.
Exactly.
So,
all right, so we got the sheets. What else?
The towels, everything, because I wanted this equestrian theme. I'm part owner of Mistral Bath Products, so we got Mistral products.
What a coincidence. Okay, keep going.
And they're out of San Diego. I just knew exactly what I wanted. Yeah. All the photography that's in the rooms is my photography.
Wow.
Yeah, so I shoot everything.
And the violin music that's playing is?
Well, it's not mine.
Okay, just double checking.
Yeah, no. But
okay.
I do have concerts.
Even better.
Yeah.
At the hotel?
At the hotel. We bring in live music. We do jazz. We do... we've actually done a little country western. We also have string quartets. We have solo violinists that come in there. But more importantly, we also have a Middleburg Film Festival.
And you got it right there.
It's right there.
Now, let's go back to the planning stages for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not doing it by buying an existing property, as I said before. You're building from scratch. So now you got to go through permits. You got to go through zoning. You got to go through environmental responsibility. You got to go through community impact. All those different things.
That's why it took 10 years. It was a very long 10 years. But also, it was a case where the community really didn't want the resort. And I had to do a most incredible selling job.
We're talking outreach.
We're talking major outreach where they had to understand the economic impact that it was going to make. Now, there were people that had been living there forever, and they go, we don't want people in our community. I'm like, yeah, and your taxes are going through the roof, and you don't have good water coming in, and you don't have businesses. We got to do something. And so now they really understand it, and it's all worked out.
Well, you know what it gets down to, and when we come back, we'll talk about this. With anything that you do, you got to be able to let people connect the dots. It's
right.
No different than, you know, that little card that's on your pillow saying, help us save the environment by not washing your towel. If you don't let people know where that money is going and how that really impacts the amount of detergent you have to use to wash that towel, they can't connect the dots. And you were talking about this before, about connecting the dots. You have to be able to educate people about the power and perhaps even the transformative power of travel. You know, we talk about this on the show all the time. It's the number one industry in the world. It's one out of every 11 jobs. And even more importantly, which speaks to your outreach, it's one out of every 5 new jobs.
Right.
And there are 93 countries right now that depend entirely for their GDP on travel and tourism. And while the industry average is about, or the international average is about 11%, there are some communities that's 40. I mean, that's all they get is travel and tourism.
That's right.
So the argument that you made, how many rooms at the hotel?
We have 168.
All right. So it's not a huge, huge hotel, but it's manageable.
Yeah. And we employ close to 400 people.
All right.
Yeah. And both full and part time.
Right. Well, that's just, that doesn't count your vendors.
Oh, no.
No. So that's just people on staff.
Right.
So when you talk about infrastructure in a community that didn't have this before, right? You found a place that just didn't have it. It gets back to the whole concept of the movie Field of Dreams. If we build it, they will come. Are they coming?
They are coming. And the reason why they're coming, we are so strategically located. I did a feasibility study. I mean, I would have never built it.
Well, you had to. You had to.
You know, I mean, we're 35 minutes from Dulles Airport, and we're about if there's no traffic, you can get there in 50 minutes from Washington, D.C. With traffic, it's about an hour and 20.
Okay.
But it's
so it's a doable weekend place.
It's a very doable weekend, and we're getting people from Capitol Hill. You would be surprised. I mean, we're getting heads of state. We I can't divulge everyone that comes, but it is amazing who shows up there.
Yeah.
I mean, I could be there and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe this person's here. And they come not just once, but they come several times. And they said it's easier to just come here than getting on a plane and going somewhere else. So we're in such a great location. And for corporate groups, it's a perfect place to have retreats. It's just a perfect location.
So here we are at the Forbes Luxury Summit. Mm-hmm. What does a five-star designation mean to you?
A dream come true. It's because we have worked so hard. And from the moment I put a shovel in the ground, I told my president of my company, Prem Devadas, I said, we're going to be Forbes five-star. That is our goal. And it's important that we keep that goal right there. And it was just a matter, we knew what we had to do. It was a lot of training because we had a lot of young people either coming
first
out of high
job,
school first, their entry jobs, and to teach them basically from setting a table correctly to greeting the guest. And it's training. It's training every day and doing it in such a way that they want to still encourage them to keep going. You know, you employ people and you lose about 40% in the very beginning. But then there's more that come in that really want to do the job.
Well, that brings up another point. You go to a restaurant in Italy, there's a 90% chance that your waiter, it's not just his job, it's his profession.
Yes.
It's something that he not only does, it's something he loves to do, and this is what he wants to do.
Yes.
The travel and tourism industry in the United States is a different ballgame.
It's totally different. And I just wish that people would understand that being a waiter is great. Being a concierge is great. Being a general manager is terrific. I mean, we are literally building careers for these people. And what is great about our company, usually some of them, even the bellmen that are at the door, if they're really great at what they do and they remember people's names and they're just so polished, we then take them to one of our other properties
and they train
everyone else. So they really are growing. They're growing in their careers, and I care about every single one of them.
Retention is a big issue, though.
Yes.
Right? That's not just your problem. That's an industry problem.
Yeah, it's an industry problem, and I hate to say this, but with millennials, they just don't stay in their jobs. They really don't. They'll stay maybe average 2-3 years, and then they're looking to the next job.
Yeah.
And that's disturbing because I really want to help them build.
You know what's interesting about that? And by the way, I see this a lot.
Yeah.
I think with millennials, we're dealing with a generation that has mobility built into their culture.
They really do.
My parents didn't. Your parents didn't.
Mm-mm.
When I was growing up, probably not. But now, of course, we think nothing of not just temporary vacations. We think of just like, I'll live there for a year. I'll live here for a year.
Right.
Right? They're not just like ski bunnies working in Colorado for the winter. It's like happening around the country. And that's what you're fighting against.
Yeah. And so often I'll sit and talk with them. I said, you know, what does your journey look like here? They said, well, I really love it here. And I'm, you know, and then they leave. And it just kind of breaks my heart. You know, you put a lot into them and helping them. And then they get a job somewhere else. Maybe it's paying $2 more. I don't know.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if it's driven by rate as more it's driven by they want a different experience. They're sampling.
Yeah.
They're sampling. But that makes your job tougher because that means the amount of money that you put into to train somebody has to be now doubled because you got to retrain somebody else.
But sometimes if they're still staying within the company.
Yeah.
You know, we have another hotel in Charleston that just opened a couple of weeks ago, and we have several of our employees. They wanted to live in Charleston, so we moved them to that hotel. But at least they're still in my company, and that's what I love.
Exactly. So now that you've got this designation, define for me, if you can, what does five-star mean for the guests? How do you take that designation and mandate it and manifest it?
Well, we really try to make sure our employees know. They all now know that we're five-star. I want to continue the training. I'm going to keep watching them. Before our guests, this has been really interesting. Some of them said, we already thought you had the five-star. We love coming here. That's why we keep coming back. Others are saying, wow, we thought you had the five-star, but now that you do have it, I'm sort of holding my breath, and if we make one little mistake, they'll say, that's not five-star service.
But so, you know, if you go back and think about it, and I'm not just applying this to the old mobile guides, which is where this came from, or the AAA. I often used to argue that what does a five-star or five-diamond resort mean? Well, it certainly means you can – it's great for employee morale, right? It also allows you to justify the rate.
Right.
But beyond that
– it's the service.
Yeah.
It is the service. And with the generation of – especially the younger generation that's coming in, they want experience. They want to experience something that's different, but yet they want to be casual. They want good food.
Yeah, the dress code's gone now, isn't it?
It's gone out the window completely.
I remember going to the Broadmoor when I was a correspondent for Newsweek back in 1973, and as I was being walked to my room by the bellman, being told that I had to have a jacket and tie to leave my room.
Whoa.
Yeah. And yeah. Those were the days, right?
Yeah.
The Ritz-Carlton Laguna, when they opened up that hotel, you know, wingtips on the beach. Really?
Well, I have to tell you, there was a elderly couple that were there one weekend, and then the woman called me on the Monday, and she says, I'm never coming back to your hotel. And I said, why? She says, you need a dress code. I have never seen people dress like that in such a classy place in all my life.
And what did you say to her?
I said, you have to understand, this is a younger generation. They want to be comfortable. They want to come there. They're in such high-powered jobs, and they just want to come and relax.
But I'll make you a bet. When you and I were growing up, if you were really good, your parents would take you out to dinner, and you dressed up.
Yes.
You did.
But you remember that from airlines, too. When you were on an airplane.
I still dress up for
you
airlines.
You were dressed.
I still dress up to fly.
I mean, in the way people come on airlines now.
Yeah. Oh, please.
Oh, God.
I know. Now, the people come on airlines now like they're in the witness relocation program.
Yeah.
I mean, or maybe fugitives from justice or both.
Right.
I know. But you don't have a dress code.
No, we don't. We don't, because if we did, I'm not sure we would fill those rooms like we do.
But
I have to say, you know, for weddings and everything, we do see incredible.
Of course.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, you got one shot out of the. You have one shot out of the gate to wear a dress you'll never wear again for the rest of your life. What a scam.
Yeah, so we have a mixed bag of everything.
Yeah.
To be very honest with you, the only thing I don't like is when people are coming from the pool, and I've seen this a few times, and they come walking through my living room in a bikini.
And you say to them.
I said, you really should cover up. We have some young people here, young kids. And I have had to speak to a couple of people about that because it was just totally inappropriate.
Although every once in a while there are some things like a five-star bikini.
No.
No.
No. Never.
The charge for looking at this pamphlet is $3. The charge for looking at this pamphlet and putting it back quickly is $4. Over the seas and all the
degrees to anywhere I please. Joining me now, an old friend of mine. We go back many, many years. He's the Vice President of Hotel Operations at the Aria Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. Paul Berry, how are you, sir?
Hi, Peter. Good afternoon. Thank you.
Let me go back to my original days in Las Vegas, covering it as a correspondent for Newsweek. Yeah. Everybody tries to define luxury. You know, it's almost an inevitably disappointing six-letter word because nobody can give you an adequate definition, not because it changes all the time, but because it is by definition different
right.
for everybody. But the one thing I could tell you, going back, you know, 40 years when I was first covering Las Vegas for Newsweek, there were no luxury hotels. They were large casinos with rooms.
Right.
That's
exactly
really what it was.
It's true.
And they're sort of like nod to luxury were their entertainers, right? And where you'd sit in those red banquet lounges, those half moon lounges.
That's right. That's
and they would have a dinner show with really bad, you know, it would be roast beef and
prime rib,
you know. and they'd do a dinner show at 8 o'clock and that was it. And the unions were there, man. They were in and out in 40 minutes.
Correct.
And one encore, see a curtain drops, we're done, right? Am I right?
Totally true. That's absolutely right.
And then one by one, some of the casinos realized maybe there's not life after gaming. In fact, in those days, they didn't call it gaming. It was gambling.
Gambling.
But then they said, well, wait a minute. How do we attract somebody who's got a better demo,
right.
Somebody who is not just going to spend money at the tables, but he's going to spend money with the sommelier,
correct.
Who's going to spend money at I hate to use the words because I think it's overused, a fine dining experience, right?
Yep.
And next thing you know, certain hotels either created those venues within the hotels or hotels became that in and of themselves.
Correct.
Aria was one of those hotels.
It was. It's actually interesting. Being in Las Vegas for 30 years, you're absolutely spot on with what you said, and we quickly.
Well, let's go back to the Bellagio because the Bellagio was 1998. Yeah,
that's right.
And I remember walking through there with Steve Wynn. He was holding onto my arm because you know we had a sight problem.
Yep.
But I was there with him 4 or 3 years earlier when they blew up the dunes.
Right.
Which is where the Bellagio sits now.
That's right.
Right? And in fact, when he blew up the dunes, I was standing next to Siegfried and Roy. They pushed the plunger.
Correct.
Remember that?
Oh, yeah, from the pirate ship.
From the pirate ship. That was crazy.
only in Vegas.
Right. But in those days, before the Bellagio, right, mm-hmm. you could have stunts, which is what they did, right?
Right.
And attractions.
Yep.
But the Bellagio could arguably be called, at that point, the first mass luxury hotel.
I would agree with that. And that was really when we were opening Bellagio, we brought in the chefs that people are, you're going to bring in celebrity chefs into Las Vegas or true gourmet fine dining. And retail came and the hotel rooms were very, very nice. And it really started to tilt away from, if you will, the gambling joint to a luxury hotel. And that was, you're absolutely right.
And the needle started to move in another direction because in terms of revenue, all of a sudden the needle started to tipping more towards entertainment and food and wine as opposed to casino games.
That's absolutely right. And that trend continues now. And really we look at Aria or Bellagio as a hotel experience that happens to have a casino as an amenity, just like it has a spa or fine dining or a retail outlet. Gambling is no longer, if you will, the leading edge or reason why people come. They come for a full integrated experience.
Right. And I remember, this is not going to come as any surprise to you because you've been there long enough to see the changes. Nobody was doing anything for hotel rooms there. They didn't want you in the rooms.
That's right.
They basically said, you check in, right? I mean, and get out of the room. And we want you on the floor with dollars in your hand on the green felt
that's
table.
So true. That's right. And again, that has since changed. I mean, that's why the hotel rooms are now luxurious. And the overall experience is that of diversity versus just simply a gambling place.
And then there's the room inventory. The little known factor of Las Vegas hotels for years was that the best rooms, the most luxurious rooms, were not controlled by the hotel general manager. They were controlled by the casino.
That is true, too.
We're talking about the rooms because I went from a room experience, a traditional room experience in Las Vegas, which is, you know, the bed and the dresser were bolted to the wall. It's true.
It's true.
Oh, my God. And nothing special about the room. In fact, they didn't want you in the room, right?
That's right.
To now, you can't wait to stay in the room.
That's right.
I mean, your room, your Sky Suites are outrageous.
Oh,
I mean, no, but they are.
Thank you.
I mean, and it's one of those things where I don't leave the room anymore. I mean, you probably want me to leave the room, but
no.
I have too much fun in there.
Sure, that's right.
But you designed them, I mean, not just for the whales, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the old tradition of you got to get the whales in and comp them everything, and then hopefully they'll drop $3 million at the table.
Yep.
This time, you dropped $3 million on the room.
That's right. And it's funny you say whales and not whales. And Sky Suites was really designed for the discerning customer, regardless of whether they are a whale or not. And frankly, we view everyone who comes through that door as our customer, as if they're coming to our home, whether they're a gambling customer or not. And that's how we welcome people.
Now, when you think of a five-star designation, I'll be devil's advocate here for a second. The last place I'd think of is a Las Vegas hotel.
Yeah, but that's since changed now, Peter. That's if you think about it, Las Vegas is still one of the more popular destinations, as you know, to come in. And people, the discerning clients want that. They wanted a luxury product, a five-star hotel. And That's exactly what we're able to do. And it's interesting. Words that come to mind like sincerity and genuineness and thoughtfulness and real. That's what we do. That's what we offer. Like I said, it's as if you're coming to our home, and people like, that's what people are searching for. That's the complete experience.
Well, let's be real here about what you've done with the Sky Suites. You've got a separate entrance.
We do.
Meaning that you're not walking necessarily through the casino to get to your room.
That's right.
The old days, you couldn't get to your room without going through the casino.
Right smack in the middle.
Even if you didn't want to play, you were going to play because you had the long march.
That's right.
It was the long march. Now you have a separate entrance, separate gate, separate doorway, and you're right up to the room.
That's right. And everyone arrives via limousine from the airport, and we meet you on the curb. We know your name. And it's people become part of the Aria family. We have an 80% return rate now.
Whoa.
And that's simply because we created what we call a culture of excellence. And that's our minimum standard, and we don't apologize for that. Having said that, people often say, well, that sounds somewhat pretentious. And no, we have a culture of excellence where we want employees to smile and laugh and be themselves and branch out to their own. And you can do it in both environments. You can have excellence as the minimum standard, and you can have people being themselves. And we've been able to create that culture. And we have found that our customers have really gravitated to that.
But when you think about it, you've been back for 30 years.
Yeah.
You've gone from casino operators that ran a hotel to hoteliers where there happens to be a casino.
That's right. And that's exactly where we are now. And yes, the casino is an amenity among many other things. And yes, we're hoteliers. We're innkeepers. And we create a culture where customers come and feel comfortable.
Okay, so here's the great question. Knowing what the metrics are to get a five-star designation or for the AAA a five diamond.
Sure.
What did you have to do?
You know, it's an interesting question, and I talk about that all the time, and people are constantly asking me, well, do you have to add this amenity or that amenity or this marble and that marble? And the answer is no. The answer is simply we hire, train the right people who want to buy into this mission, who want to buy into being part of something incredible.
Well, no amount of technology or design is going to take the place of bad service.
No, that's right. And even with our technology, we always view technology to enhance the service, not technology for the sake of technology.
By the way, my biggest pet peeve is when a hotel, whatever hotel it is, they want to tell you like they're the new cutting-edge hotel, and you have to go through a seven-hour tutorial to use the remote control.
That's right.
Or to set the thermostat.
And that just frustrates you.
When I built my house years ago, my contractor came to me and said, we got the latest HVAC, we got everything, and it's got this dial and this dial and this, and you can do it from your car. And I said, here's what I want you to do. And he looked at me like I was crazy. He said, I want you to go to a hardware resale store and get the old Honeywell wheel. On, off. Right. That's all I want.
Correct.
And he went, really? I said, trust me, it works.
That's right. That's exactly right. And you just want things to be easy for people and not frustrating for people.
Yeah.
So that's a fine line, too, to be able to combine technology with simplicity.
Well, it's the age-old argument between high tech and high touch.
Correct.
Right.
That's right.
And what's the one thing you want to improve?
I would tell you we want to be we are very consistent all of the time, but you want to be consistent day in and day out completely all of the time, I would tell you. I think we can...
But that's sort of like redundant, consistent all the time.
Yeah, that's true. I guess I would tell you we're also looking to different at different potential different avenues and venues to bring in, and you're always looking to improve our we're always looking to improve what we do with new ways of doing it.
And of course, in terms of guest recognition, you want to make sure that if you put this soap in the bathroom for the person the last time and they liked it, you'll make sure that soap comes
100%.
Back.
100%.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.